Our Facebook follower of Teistic Media Studio sent us a question. His name is Yelena Yongzon, and he's from Philippines. Mm-hmm. So his question saying, what's good in our disappointment?
What is good about being disappointed?
Right.
Is that it can be a catalyst for detachment. Just as in one place, Srila Prabhupada says in a purport in the Bhagavad Gita, and I'm paraphrasing, but he says, when one realizes that material existence is a constant source of perplexity at every step, he said, it behooves such a person to approach a spiritual master. And I've appended to that, not only realized as a constant source of perplexity, but a never-ending series of humiliations. So at the root cause of material existence is the rain in heaven mania, what Guru Maharaj, referring to Milton's Paradise Lost, as satanic mania, that I will realize myself, achieve self-fulfillment, self-realization in the master position. When humanism is their sloganeering, which permeates advertising, they're dealing with this principle also, but giving affirmations that this sort of achievement is almost, it's within reach. So, as I mentioned before, in New Age philosophy, which was prominent in the 1980s in America, but one thing, creative visualization. If you visualize an outcome, you can achieve that. And athletes use this. So everything has some utility. But their underlying this is that if you just visualize this, and it's almost, it's interesting in that it's an inadvertent reference to subjective evolution, or a suggestive proof, because they're saying, if you conceive this, it can go from the subjective plane into the objective and become an objective outcome. And we could think, well, don't we do that all the time? Like we're here, we're talking about when we make the buildings, the studio, the temple, we're envisioning something subjectively, and we're envisioning an outcome. And sometimes for that, we like to show pictures or aids, because when we discuss things, what image you have in your mind and what image I have in my mind, they may not be the same. So we have a visual aid. Today we're looking at flag. We say, here, this red color, this shape, this size. And then we can all have some consensus. And going a little deeper with this kind of thought is the great poet T.S. Eliot, in his theory of poetry, he has a term that he calls objective correlative. And what he means by that is, as a poet, you're trying to convey a concept or feeling to another person, and through the medium of sound or words. Right? You want them to really, not to just visualize things, but to feel something be sympathetic to a particular point of view, angle of vision, or humanity as it might be. So in his theory of the objective correlative, he's saying, there's a way that you can assemble words in any language And not like as an algorithm, like that a computer or a robot could do this, but a interpreter, poets, the arbiters of reality, will assemble the words in such a way to, and we assume an inspired state, so that when you hear them or consider them, a particular feeling, mood, empathy will come to you. So he's saying, we're seeking that. The objective correlative, what are the things that we will say that will get that outcome? That's interesting. But another thing that comes to mind, just for the sake of, you know, TARC, argument, counter-argument, is Wittgenstein, the, you could almost say, bastard disciple of Bertrand Russell, but I mean that in the literary sense of the word, like an offspring who, put it this way, Bertrand Russell realized in Wittgenstein that he had a problem. So, and Wittgenstein, who is arguably the greatest linguistic philosopher of the 20th century, said one, he lived on a petrol station above one, and every day the men in the station, they would make coffee. So he would be above there working on his almost, you know, indecipherable works for most. And the aroma of the coffee would come wafting upstairs, and he would smell that coffee, and it would, there'd be some reaction, maybe awaken some desire for a cup of coffee or mood enhancement, whatever. But then he realized and said, with all my linguistic skills, my ability, expertise with words, I can't use them to convey to you the aroma of coffee. You understand? There's no words that I can arrange in such a way that you'll actually smell coffee, is what he's saying. I can describe it in various ways, compare it to things, but I can't make you smell it, experience that aroma. Which in one sense I think was, you know, a statement of humility. But to stay on theme, so when we realize whatever it is we're meditating on subjectively, internally, and we're envisioning an objective outcome, and by this we would say, what is the opposite of disappointment is fulfillment. So we're thinking that this person, place, or thing coming in connection with them, I'll achieve fulfillment. I'll be happy and fulfilled. It's a, we do this every, it's not limited to thinking like, who's my life partner, my better half, my soulmate, you know, my complementary aspect. Not just that. We do it every day for so many times daily. But humanism, humanistic sloganeering is all similar thematically in its appeal. And where is it most prominent? Is in modern advertising. As the great playwright Arthur Miller, most famous work, Death of a Salesman, when he was interviewed in the latter part of his life, because there was a time, I mentioned, in England they called poets the arbiters of reality. They were considered the interpreters. You have the king, the government, you know, so many lords, but to the poets, they looked for, like, give us some direction, give some meaning to our lives, what we should aspire for. So they're called the arbiters of reality. They'll decide, this is a noble pursuit, this is less than noble. Right? Such a high position they occupied, particularly the one called the Poet Laureate of England, was highly respected, and their opinion was valued, in a sense, above all others. And as a footnote or sidebar, that tells us that really they want to defer to those who spend the vast majority of their lives in subjective cultivation. It's an indirect way of acknowledging that the real substantial thing is located in the subjective plane and not in the objective world. These people, kings, queens, lords, they already possess what one could want objectively. Yet they're looking to these poets for some guidance to go internal, and Guru Maharaj's word, to dive deep into reality. That they want to know. That their lives are not a useless malengagement, to quote a term Guru Maharaj uses. So Arthur Miller, that was England, the Victorian age, you can say. But as the Romantics, Victorians, Modernists, a shift took place where, coinciding with external events like World War I, remember it was called the Great War, and sometimes called the War to End All Wars. They thought this was so devastating. So many millions of people died. Even in the last 2 months, millions of people died from disease. So it was so horrible that people thought, this is so bad. Certainly, don't we all agree, all the nations on either side who were involved in, this is it. This is the end of all of that. Not so. And at that time, in the aftermath, that was in 1917, so in the aftermath came a time in America they call the Roaring Twenties, also sometimes referred to as the Jazz Age. And this, we'll see, this happens cyclically. When people are on the verge of death, when death is a real possibility, they either go internally, engage in deep spiritual culture, or go outward in the hedonistic, thinking like, carpe diem, seize the day. We could be dead tomorrow. Let's enjoy as much as we can tonight. Right? That's carpe diem, seize the day. And poets are always great seducers of women using this. This is the oldest pickup line in poetry. Is that you will never look more beautiful than you look now. Who knows what will happen tomorrow? So therefore, so the poets, that's where they're using those words to get a particular objective outcome. We know what their objective correlative is in this sense. But so that age comes in the aftermath of the Great War. And interestingly, the artist, René Magritte, he has a painting of the famous man in the bowler hat, wearing a bowler, and there's an apple in front of his face. And the title of it is The Great War. He is one of the most philosophical of painters. And I would suggest what he's saying is the Great War is between the subjective and the objective world. That's the Great War that we're always involved in. But at any rate, in the aftermath there, and you'll see some poets in England, again, who may have had some insight where things were going, Matthew Arnold, Dover Beach, saying, the sea of faith was once, the world was once enshrouded in the sea of faith, and now it's all I see here. He's seen this ocean go in and out and the sound of the gravel and coming. He said, now that sea of faith, I only hear its long withdrawing roar. And what he means to say is, this war, it damaged the faith of the people. Their belief in God or divinity, their belief in humanity. They were damaged. So much so that Gertrude Stein called Hemingway, Picasso, Joyce, and all of those great writers, artists, things assembled at her salon in Paris, the Génération Perdue, the lost generation. I mean, you're lost. Their faith had been damaged. They were followed by the Beats, who they said, yes, we're beaten down to the point of there's nothing left, but we want to believe again. So this subjective-objective, alternating current of seeking one's fulfillment in the subjective plane, objective world. Or people who want to make a compromise of the two. So, I'm going the long way. So when they asked Arthur Miller, by the time he came around, it was went from poets to playwrights as the arbiters of reality, we'll say. And they'd look to them like, so in your play, you're dealing with the human condition and what we learn from you about what are the possibilities of life and family, relationships, existence. But that began to wane in the late 50s, early 60s, giving way to movies, television, computer, Game Boy, PlayStation. We went a long way from all these and all this stuff to this. So when in his final days they asked him, did he have any observations to share about what happened from the poet to the playwright to the present position? And he said something I find very interesting. He said, today, he said, most people, they get their concepts from advertising. And we know the advertisers, particularly in America, they, around this time of year actually, they go to the better universities and interview students from psychology departments and who they see as potential employees, students in their advertising culture, which is to do what? We say, to address unfulfilled desire. That will never end. We know that in the Bhagavad Gita, no matter how much, that'll be a constant. Other things can be fulfilled, but unfulfilled desire is an endless source of seductive possibility. Right? So he said, most people get their concepts today from advertising. And we observe that humanistic sloganeering is all pervasive in advertising. And what do I mean by that? MasterCard. Master the possibilities. That's their campaign to you. You see yourself as a master, not as a slave of circumstance, of karmic destiny. When you've got our card, you will master all possibilities. You will master those circumstances. You need to be somewhere else, you pull out your card and give it to them, and then you go there. You need to eat something, pull this card out. You get food beyond your imagination. So get them. No one wants like a servant card. Want the master card. Okay. What Nike? Just do it. What is the implication of that? Is that, you know, that little voice you have inside your conscience that says, maybe you shouldn't be doing this? They go, just do it. Just go ahead and do it. You can do it. In creative visualization, there was an Australian company. They even used these words. They said, it was about the products, the food products they were selling. They said, you know that little voice inside that says, maybe you should restrain yourself and refrain, you know. They said, yeah, we don't either. We don't have that voice of self-restraint, what Solzhenitsyn called voluntary, serene self-restraint, right, to deal with human nature. Right. That's akin to what is prescribed in the Vedic line. Not freedom for the senses, freedom from the senses. There are really only two possibilities. You're a slave of Maya or a slave of Yoga Maya. Right. Freedom for the senses, freedom from the senses. Freedom from the senses is liberation. Not that liberation means unbridled, unrestrained sense, sensuality. Right. So just do it. Right. Master the possibilities. I mentioned when I went to Russia, I'd been there in 1978, and then I came back again in 2000. In 78, you went to the store, there was a brown paper bag with a kilo of sugar, or, you know, and it said on it, in a stencil, what's the word for sugar? Zahar, with an X, right?
Yes. Yeah.
That's what it said. You know, came back, that was in 1978. Came back in the year 2000 from Sheremetyevo, the airport, to, the Kremlin. Or I must have seen, and I'm not exaggerating actually, 100 L'Oreal ads. Every street, a banner across every block, a L'Oreal ad, all the way back to the city. And what is their slogan? You know, L'Oreal. And they say, why? Because I'm worth it. Again, they're appealing that. You're worth it. You're number one. You're the best. You rule. All appealing to that master ego. And one company went so far, we could say they were being somewhat facetious, or, but still, their slogan was, total indulgence, zero guilt. That was their slogan. It happened to be for like weight reduction, but still, they said, total indulgence, zero guilt. These are the message. And what did Miller say? Most people in the modern world get their concepts about self, identity, prospect, potential from advertising. And it's all saturated, permeated by humanistic sloganeering. That's saying, if you will only believe in yourself and envision but your desired outcome, you will achieve that. That's all you need. Self-belief, envision the desired outcome, and we can help you do that for $9.99 monthly subscription, or you know we have different when you have different models. No, I'm saying you have like a one membership, a higher level membership. Huh?
Plans.
Tier plans. I'm being facetious. Right. So, One kind of person seduced by this satanic mania to reign in hell, right? I remember as children, when there would be, like you're talking about bringing the soil, and the dump truck would come and dump a bunch of soil, and then the kids would come, before they used it, come and play a game called I'm King of the Hill. And someone would be on the top, and then others try and pull them down. But they would go to the top and say, I'm King of the Hill. It's the same thing. But what we might add to that, what hill, what is that hill made of that you're king or queen of? There's a popular emoticon that would symbolize that. Sorry to bring that imagery into your mind. But I mean, king of a hill of stool, right? It means of what is excrement, to be eliminated, actually, that it has been sapped of its vitality. Punak punak charvita charvananam Prahlad Maharaj says, chewing the chewed. Already, whatever little juice was there. And Philip Roth, who died recently, in one of his books, a character says about this world, what's his realization? You never get more than a taste. That's all you're ever given. And anything is just a little taste of that possible happiness, but you'll never get more than that. But just that taste alone is enough to keep seducing someone again and again to try and achieve that. But if they come to the point, as Prabhupada said, they realize material existence is a constant source of perplexity at every stage, addended, a never-ending series of humiliations, and your attempt to find self-fulfillment, self-realization, actualization, realize your potential by acquiring, controlling, and consuming things that are lower than you. If you become disappointed enough, if your disappointment reaches utter frustration, then you may seek your prospect elsewhere. Then we could say, Brahmanda Brahmite Kona Bhagyavan Jeev. The Bhagyavan, the fortunate ones, then they come in connection with an agent of reality who comes with a message that, like Prahlad, we're saying, Nate vidu swartha gatim Vishnu durasaye bahir artamanina. Bahir artha means, your focus is misdirected and should be inverted. You're looking for the substantial thing in the cover, right? Like in the breast-obsessed world that we live in. Now that I'm mentioning, right, Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels. You know Gulliver, that's famous, right? Everyone's heard of that. Most people know one of the, there's four travels. One travel is he goes to the land of the Lilliputians where he's giant and they're all tiny. And there's a fire and he extinguishes the fire. We'll leave that to your imagination, how he did that. But in another land, he's very tiny and they're giants. And he's so, they think he's so cute and charming, this little miniature, that he's given to a girl for like her 16th birthday or something like that. And she thinks it's like a cute toy, and she sometimes keeps him on her breast. And then he has a description in there, what a like 30 meter diameter breast looks like. From that, like, that microscopic view. And of course, this is meant to be humorous. But what he's also telling you is like, if you magnify this up close, it's not going to be so appealing. That's what he's saying. Which is interesting. That's what Shankaracharya says. In the Moha Mudgura Stotram Naribanas Starana Nabhi Desham Drishtamaga Mahavesham. So they're saying you're seeking fulfillment in the shell, in the skin, right? In the outer part, when the substantial thing is within. Right? That's in the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj. How consistent it is. From one point of view, we could say what Prahlad is saying, maybe he said it 150 million years ago. Right? And it's still relevant. How many things were said 150 million years ago that are still relevant? Everything Prahlad said. So it shows the consistent assessment of what are the flaws of material existence and seeking fulfillment outwardly in the objective world. So if one becomes disappointed with that, they say, I've tried everything in so many different ways. That's what Brahmanda Brahmite means. Brahmanda means the universe. So, and it says wandering the universe. We might think, oh, like in a sci-fi movie, you know, they went from one planet to another planet, there's different conditions, like that. But it's a Vedic understanding, a little different. It's not just like in the external world, this place is hot, this place is cold, this place has a nice temperate climate. That's very superficial and external. What? Back to the objective correlative, the objective world is constituted of deluded aspirations. It's based on delusion. As the body is the biological expression of the soul's delusion, the universe is the deluded playground of conditioned souls. So, Om Bhur Bhuva Sva means from gross exploitation or gross misunderstanding toward subtle exploitation, subtle misunderstanding, but still misunderstanding. Right? In Charitamritam, what is that sloka? You know, when dvaita dvaita badre, sab manudharm, a bal, a manda, a sub brahm. So let's say, sab manudharm, this whole world is just like a dream in that there's nothing substantial here, really, in the objective world. If we did time-lapse photography, we would, like, in the time machine. This is a literature class. And you see very quickly someone go through the stages of aging. Or we're actually doing that right now. But we're not, and we're seeing it in real time. But if we recorded this and sped it up fast, you see, since I started speaking, we've aged somewhat. Yeah. So why did I say that? Because, talking about misconception, Bhur Bhuvasva, Swargaloka, the whole objective world. That it's based on misconception, that is the point. Right? Varieties of misconception. It's a misconceived world. We have misconceived identity in a misconceived world. So when one reaches the point of being frustrated by repeated attempts to establish oneself as a, to egocentrism, to establish yourself as the center of exploiting capacity, right? And trying to expand the circumference of that, and you realize that it's not working. It's not happening. Even if you get everything your way, at last you have to die. This is definitely a literature poetry class. What Gurudev liked, and Guru Maharaj's a poet, Gray's Elegy, the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, a way to like the inevitable hour, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. Thomas Nash, Litany in a Time of Plague, when he say, beauty is but a flower, wrinkles will devour, brightness falls from the air, queens have died both young and fair. Every day I see those champak flowers, and they're so beautiful in the morning. The texture, their shape, their form, everything. And by the end of the day, they start wilting and wrinkling, and the next morning, they're brown and wrinkled. And it's easy to observe in a flower because it happens in one day. That's what happens in this world. Right? But when you're in the nice flower stage, you think, oh, well, I still look pretty good. Holding out for that prospect. But with intelligence, spiritual intelligence awakened, we're supposed to see, oh, look how what happened. The beauty is but a flower, wrinkles will devour. Brightness falls from the air, queens have died, both young and fair. Memento mori, death reminders. It's a healthy thing to be aware of that. And in terms of egocentrism and establishing yourself as an absolute center and trying to expand one's exploiting, the circumference of one's exploiting capacity from there, we have Shelley and Ozymandias, where the narrator of the poem says, I met a traveler from an ancient land who told me something interesting he saw out in the desert. He said there was a statue, but broken, like, say, from the waist down, but chest broken, head over here. The head's like tilted in the sand. And there's an inscription at the base and says, I am Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my kingdom, ye mighty in despair. And he said, that whoever the sculptor was, he said, if you look at the face over in the sand tilted, he really captured this man's arrogance in the face. Couldn't a good portrait artist, you can't hide from them. So he said, it was there in the face. And then look at this statement. I am Ozymandias, King of Kings. I'm King of the Hill. Look upon my kingdom, ye mighty in despair. And he said, and when you look, all you see are sand dunes and desert sands. No kingdom, nothing. But there was a time when he had a kingdom and it was made of stone and so many things and now just desert sand. How many times have we been Ozymandias and everything in between? When you come to the point of realizing this program of trying to fulfill myself, achieve my reality potential, being outwardly directed, is not only disappointing but endlessly frustrating and leading me to the point of feeling helpless, hopeless, which is a good thing. The humanist, oh, how dare you say, we've come, we stand against this kind of, we're here to tell everybody, you know, everyone is beautiful in their own way. It's not untrue, but physically speaking, it's not true. So, doinya atmani vedan goptitve baran. The shadanga saranagati, the six limbs, they're sometimes mentioned in a different order, but interestingly here in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's song, he begins with doinya. And we can take that to mean just like hopeless, help. When you've reached that point, you realize, not only can I not help others, I can't help myself. That is not cowardice. It takes courage to admit that. The humanist will say, that's a cowardly act. Right? No, it and go on boasting humanistic slogans, which the ultimate, who takes it beyond them? The Brahmavadis, Aham Brahmasmi. I'm not only great, I'm not only, you know, number one on Instagram or Facebook, I'm the supreme Brahman. How about that? Like Guru Maharaj said, these Brahmavadis, Mayavadis particularly, he said, they can give up everything. We've seen them. Gopal, you've seen them. Not any clothes they wear, the Nagababas. Nothing. Wearing some ash, right? Walking around like that. Said they can give up everything, including their name. I met one on the way to Badrinath. I said, what is your name? Tyagi Baba. Where are you from? Nowhere. He has eliminated, like, remembering any town, my name. I just, Tyagi means, you know, I reject everything. When I was walking in San Jose once, and during the, when punk rock was very prominent, and these two punks, they saw me with a shaved head, and they were like, and they, but then the saffron dress, and they came up to me and they said, what's this all about? What's this supposed to mean? And I said to them, total rejection of everything. And they said, cool. But what are you accepting? Yes, we agree. Yeah, this is all, reject it all. Right. And accept what? Oh, nobody knows. Nobody you know. Nobody knows. No, nobody you know. So when you reach this state and have the courage to admit you're hopeless, that it's odd, the humanists, they don't berate addicts and alcoholics, but rather say, oh, what courage it takes for them to acknowledge that. Yes. And then you see a transformation can take place. In a similar way, it takes courage to recognize what the human situation is. Not only can you not help others in any truly lasting sense, you cannot even help yourself. That's the fact. Those are the facts of the matter. And we don't mean temporary help. We're talking about permanent, lasting. Right. So, doinya, when you can admit that, then you can, that disappointment with your mundane prospect leads you to seek your reality potential. And not in the humanistic sense, but in the spiritual sense. When Srila Guru Maharaj was sent to merely collect a donation, the donation was already considered given. They said, go to this man. This is India, so even the government, they set aside some money for spiritual things. Go there, just pick up the check. Basically, you know, say a few kind words or a little harikata, get the check. We want to build a mot. But that man who had promised that before, he was removed, and there's a new man there. So when Guru Maharaj comes, that man said, if there is are any surplus funds, the last thing we would give it for is a mot. We will help the people with food distribution or shelter, that if there are any surplus funds. Not for your mat, your spiritual temple, ashram, no. And Guru Maharaj started saying, he was told he would just collect, now he's going to go back with nothing. And they're expecting a big amount. And he's thinking, what to do? And he felt hopeless, actually. Helpless, hopeless, like what? what is this situation I find myself in? And he's praying to the Lord for some inspiration. And the inspiration, because Guru Maharaj is so unique, and the quality of his sincerity, what it will bring. This sloka came to him. Vikriditam braja budhu viridam ca Vishnu Swadhanvato anusunaya databarnayaja bhakti param bhagavati bhakti pratilabdhikamam hridrogam hridrogam ashu api chirat api hinoti achirena dhira. So it's the sloka where Sukadev Goswami has been just described the Rasa Leela. It's Krishna and the Gopis. And some of these sages are mouths open in disbelief. You told in the beginning, Jugupsitam Dharma Kritain Anushasana, like religion is what's ruined the world. And now you're saying, you know, that these apparently immoral, not only is God a man, but he's an immoral man. He's not only human-like, but he's like an immoral human. That's the highest religion. Regular religion is a menace to the people, but this new religion here, Krishna culture, the pastimes of this immoral human-like, that's the highest religion. Prabhu! It's all there for a reason. Everyone's playing a part, a role, to bring out. And Parikshit Maharaj sees the looks on their face. He can sense their, what's the word? Reticence, but there's another word. Their apprehension. And then ask Sukadev, in the beginning, you told us this, now you're saying this, how shall we understand? And this verse comes. These pastimes, krida, we were talking about that the other day, krida, play, but vikriditam, idam, brajabiduvir, idam jabishnu, it means this, divine, we'll just say sweet pastimes of Radha and Krishna and Braja Gopis. That hearing about this from Krishna-loving, qualified people will actually cure the heart of lust, of the desire, of the unfulfilled desires that we're trying to quench. And the objective world. Hridrogam, it's identified. Heart disease. We're told in the beginning, Tene Brahma Hrida, it's a heart-to-heart transaction. But at present, the heart is knotted. It's lust, desire has a stranglehold on the heart. So it's not truly expressing itself. What the book called the deep heart's core is not being expressed. So the Bhagavatam says, Bidyate hridaya granti chidyante sarva sangshaya chiyante chasya karmani mayi drishte akilatmani. Hearing about Krishna, the knots, the stranglehold that lust has in heart will be released. Then the real heart flow will come. So, at present, the heart disease, hridrogam. And then Guru Maharaj got some inspiration, and we only say this because it's what he said. But he said to that man in a very moving way about desire and it being unsatisfied, disappointed, unfulfilled. He said, when I was in the body of an elephant, including transmigration as well. When I was in the body of an elephant, I ate jungles and my hunger was not satisfied. There's an elephant camp near here. How much did they eat a day? 100 kilos? 300 kilos. And not satisfied. Then he said, when I was in the body of a stool-eating pig, I ate hills of stool, and my hunger wasn't satisfied. And that man began to cry. And he said, Swamiji, I believe in God. Guru Maharaj got through, and Guru Maharaj said, your tears are the evidence of that. And so Guru Maharaj continued by saying, so what, by establishing a food distribution center, that's not going to relieve the suffering condition of a soul plagued by unfulfilled desires that are plaguing the heart. But in the mat, in the temple, where you can hear about Krishna, Madan Mohan Krishna, everyone in this world is Madan, has been hit by the arrow of Kandarva, of Madan. Eros. The arrow of Eros. And what is Krishna? How is Krishna described by Brahma? Kandarpakoti kamani abhishesha shobham. Yang shama sundaram achintya guna swarupam. The achintya guna swarup of Krishna is what? Like kandarpakoti shobham. The beauty, seductive charm of 10 million cupids personified in one. I think, well, that's poetry. It sounds very beautiful and hyperbolic. No. What it means is, so then, oh, if attraction toward Krishna can be awakened, then it can cut the knots of the stranglehold that Cupid has on the heart. That's what it means. That's the beauty of Krishna conception. These things have to be connected in a practical, realizable way. So we think, oh, what can give me relief from this? Something infinitely more beautiful and superior. Raso varjam raso pyasya param dishvani vartate. Not just taking something away. You see the baby, you take something away from the baby. But if you go, oh, look, try this. This is even better. They drop that thing. Oh, then they're happy. Experience a higher taste, deeper experience, means in the subjective world, dive deep into reality. So, if this world, Brahmanda Brahmite, from, it's all just misconceived, misconceived identity in the misconceived world. If we become so disappointed that we feel utterly helpless and hopeless, that puts us in a ripe position for receiving some mercy. Guru Krishna Prashade Pai Bhakti Lata Beej. Then the soil's ready for the implantation of Krishna conception. Pravishta Karna Randrena Swanam Bhavam Sarouham Dunoti Shamalam Krishna Shalyasya Yatasharat. When does Sharat season start?
Before winter.
After autumn. Yeah, because we thought that's after the rain, then everything becomes clear.
Yeah, that's Sharat.
That's why it's in this. So it's saying like all these things, this cloudiness, the layers of like. There's no polite word for what floats on the top of the water. Sometimes algae, scum, it's called, becomes clear. Pravishta Karna Randrena. Krishna Karna Amrita means nectar for the ear and heart. Enters through the ear and cleanses the heart. So Guru Maharaj is saying, what the world needs, Harikatat Durvika, there's a famine of this thing. There's enough of everything else. The only famine, short as there is, as of substantial Krishna katha, hearing about him. So this is how our disappointment can lead us to something substantial, to become detached from the mundane and send us in the direction of becoming attached to what is genuinely spiritual. And just to conclude, Krishna tells Uddhava, Jata Shradamat Katasu Nirvina Sarva Karmasu Veda Dukatmakan Kaman Prityage Pyaniswara. Said, my devotee, aspiring servitor, devotee, they have faith in the hearing about me. They like that. Some taste is developing in them, some inclination for that. But still, there may be some lingering remembrance or mundane hankering, lingering still. And sometimes it overwhelms them and pulls them, and they're seeking fulfillment, sensual fulfillment in the objective realm. He said, but they like hearing about me, being associating with Krishna-loving people, engaged in service. He's saying, gradually, my conception will spread its influence on them. And that lingering hankering will diminish to the point of vanishing altogether. So it's something very hopeful. He's saying, so go on continuing hearing about me and associating with the Krishna-loving people and doing seva, and gradually any lingering mundane hankering will vanish. And then we'll realize that, I will say this too, to conclude. In Krishna consciousness, one thing we can extract from this sloka is to understand that because he's saying they repent. There's repentance, gariyan, of lingering attraction for the mundane. So lamentation. So in Krishna consciousness, to lament one's lack of Krishna consciousness or lack of achievement is a good thing, is a substantial thing. Lamentation finds its value when expressed toward Krishna conception. Hare Krishna.